We're going to continue talking with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, PhD, and of course, take your phone calls as we talk about the hunt for Sasquatch, an incredible story. And also, don't forget Jeffrey's book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. More to come on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Jeff Meldrum with us. Jeff, tell me a little bit about the work of John Bindernagel and what he does.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Bindernagel is a wildlife biologist. He now resides on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. And he has, interestingly, followed a similar parallel path as some of my career development when it comes to the Sasquatch question, but from a different perspective. Mine from anatomy and anthropology, his from the perspective of a wildlife biologist. He's written two extremely influential and must-read books, which really couches the question of Sasquatch as a North American ape from the perspective of a wildlife biologist. He navigates the primate literature very deftly. And his second book is quite interesting. It delves more into the philosophy of science and the process of discovery and the difficulty sometimes experienced by investigators overcoming pre-existing notions, pre-existing paradigms. And his thesis is basically that Sasquatch has been discovered. It just has not yet been recognized by science, and does a very good job of making a convincing case for that argument. So very important contributions to the field.
All right, let's take some of the calls with you if we can. Let us go to Jay in Hamden, Connecticut. Jay, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Jay.
Hey, George. Hey, Jeff. How you doing tonight?
Good.
Great.
Oh, excellent. Jeff, I'm a big fan of yours. The last couple of years, like I'm sure many Americans out there, I've been watching Finding Bigfoot on a regular basis. I love the show and have become, you know, fascinated with the whole Sasquatch concept. And I was just wondering your opinion on the show itself, Finding Bigfoot, and mm-hmm. how you think it could maybe be improved.
Well, I have to admit up front that I don't have cable TV and don't watch these shows regularly myself. I catch a few of them when I'm traveling and sitting alone in a motel room late in the evening before drifting off to sleep. Those that I've seen, and I have been involved with a couple of the productions, have been very intriguing. I really enjoy the town hall meetings, the opportunity to hear the firsthand accounts of people who come out to share their experiences with the team. They're obviously constrained by a very tight schedule as to what they can accomplish in those two or three days that they're at any one location. I'm good friends, particularly with Cliff, and we exchange information on a very regular basis and consult back and forth. And you know, I'm very pleased to see as Cliff has educated himself and hopefully sucked up a little of my experience along the way, and vice versa, in his analysis of the footprints. He's really made some good observations, and his questions have often triggered in me connections and insights that have opened up new realizations when it comes to the form and function of the Sasquatch footprints. Obviously any time a show is what in their sixth, seventh season now, and basically
you can't beat that, Jeff.
Yeah, it's been successful, but you start to wear out the formula a little bit. I would love to see them branch out. I mean, they did that, I guess, when they went international. I've seen a couple of their international episodes, and I guess they're doing some more filming internationally. It certainly has clearly illustrated that there, through its popularity, that there is a huge interest in this subject amongst the public, amongst the populace at large. There's no getting around that.
What's going on now with Les Strod's show, Survivor Man Bigfoot? What's happening there?
Right. Well, he did a two-part episode special episode by under that name where he went into the field with Todd Standing. And, you know, Les went in there, and in personal conversations with him, he was quite clear that he went in there with the attitude that if he detected a hoax, he would that would be the story. That would be he would expose it and reveal it to the light of day. But obviously, he was impressed enough that when given the opportunity to continue with the series, and he's now produced a half a dozen or so additional episodes of Survivor Man Bigfoot that'll begin to air here shortly, early in the spring, I think, is the schedule timeline. So he clearly was intrigued enough by the experiences, by his objective assessment of the experiences he had with Todd, that that he has pursued it and gone off and visited a number of other locations and spent some time with other investigators, gaining insights from their experience and collecting evidence. He plans to come to my lab here next month and bring that accumulated evidence so we can kind of sort through it and evaluate it and analyze it, and that'll be sort of the wrap-up episode, I suspect.
All right, let's go to Mike in Plainville, Connecticut. Mike, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, good morning. Merry Christmas, gentlemen. It sounds like these Bigfoot have a lot going on. They're proficient in hunting, gathering, making tools, running, jumping, and I think they're very sensitive to electronic equipment. That's why people can't get a good picture of them on tree cameras. And I think they can see you coming from miles away. They may have enhanced night vision. Maybe they're not from Earth. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, the litany of characteristics, there's a lot of speculation sprinkled in amongst that. We can only work with what we have, really, and I tend to kind of try to stay grounded and not to go too far beyond, you know, drawing outside the line, coloring outside the line, so to speak. So far, the evidence suggests to me that they don't have tools. Their only use of tools is very, you know, opportunistic employment of objects at hand, much like a chimp cracking a nut with a rock or probing a termite mound with a stick. As far as their origin, being extraterrestrial, again, I don't have any personal experience with any evidence to point to that. But on the other hand, I don't have any experience otherwise to falsify that hypothesis. It's just, so far, everything points to it being a biological species, just another form of wildlife out there. It just happens to be in the order primates instead of ungulates or carnivores.
All right, let me go, Jeff. Let's go to Francine in Los Angeles. Francine, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Good evening, gentlemen. Two of my paranormal crushes on talking at the same time. I think it's the mustache on you two. Professor Meldrum, I have the highest respect for you, sir, and have been watching you for some time. I wonder if I can ask you a question about the research that's been done with David Pilates and Dr. Melba Ketchum with the mitochondrial and nuclear DNA. This is a woman who pioneered DNA research and actually mapped the canine genome and claims that she has done the research and recognized that Bigfoot is mitochondrially a human and nuclearly the father, a unknown primate. And I just wondered if you can give some information, because she suffered very greatly because of getting into this and hadn't been into the field at all, got into it and now has really gone on hard times because of this. If you can just address that, sir, and I'll take your answer all off the air. And thank you both for all the work you do, gentlemen.
Well, Francine, you're very welcome. The DNA studies by Dr. Ketchum, not conclusive, Jeff. Go ahead.
No, right. Well, yes, and that's a topic. It's hard to provide a short answer to that question. and fully qualify it. But the short answer is I don't see compelling evidence to support her hypothesis of a hybrid species based on what was published and numerous people who have reviewed her paper have come to a similar conclusion. One of the phylogenies or the spanning trees suggested a close affinity to a prosimian primate. And she was quoted on a radio talk show suggesting that was surprising. She came to realize that there was a subfossil lemur in Madagascar that was 450 pounds, a big giant sloth-like lemur. I mean, what does that supposed to mean? that this human that crossed with a giant extinct lemur from Madagascar 15,000 years ago. I mean, there were so many strange and odd interpretations. Now, whether she has any good sequence data remains to be seen. The whole handling of the publication of the manuscript is a strange story in and of itself. Many who have looked at the sequences that have been published have commented that it's a hodgepodge of DNA from different species. So, I mean, setting any potential data aside for a moment and contemplating the hypothesis that some human female interacted with an unknown hominoid, and that produced an entirely separate species, ultimately, that then spread from Northern Europe throughout Asia, presumably into North America. I mean, it's hard to imagine a context, a hook, upon which to hang that particular hypothesis. So this is a challenge. It's always a challenge in science. Oftentimes, new ideas have to find a niche, and Sasquatch has suffered generally under that, not this particular hypothesis in this case, but just the notion of there being a relic hominoid. And that's been one of the things that I've been trying to do, is to create rather draw attention to that niche. This notion, I can talk to my colleagues about relic hominoids where I can't talk with them about Sasquatch. Just the connotation, the distinction of connotation of those two terms is enough to either open their minds to the possibility that there could be populations persisting from this bushy hominoid tree versus the notion that there's a man-like monster lurking in the wilderness of North America. It's kind of interesting psychological study,
sure,
but that's life. That's the reality of the thing.
All right, we've got a couple of your conference members and also William Barnes on the phone, too. But let's first go to William Kachulfi, who is putting on the expedition in South Africa. William, sounds like a great project and undertaking. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, George, and hello, Dr. Meldrum. How are you doing?
Hi, Bill.
Hi. I've had a lot of people ask me, why I want to put a conference on like this. And I started this back in 1984. I lead international expeditions around the world, and I thought it was a good platform for a business to support a scientist in his field of endeavor. And I work with Dr. Mark Miller on a number of expeditions around the world on cryptozoological levels. And I've been 30 years in business, and I'm fortunate enough to have a South African partner that owns a game reserve in South Africa, where Dr. Leakey found Lucy's footprints. And when I tied all this together, I talked to one of my buddies, Steve Hanks, and talked him into going out to see Dr. Meldrum, who was interested in seeing us for the day. And when I approached Dr. Meldrum about, hey, look, I'm willing to take some of my funds and put a conference together, and let's address this subject that some biological entity is leaving proof in the footprint form, I decided to take this project on hand, and I approached Dr. Meldrum about it, and he was game. So that's why we're putting on this international conference and bringing the academia together to address this subject.
Well, it sounds like you're all in on this one, Bill, right?
I'm 100% on this, George, 100%. And, you know, when I vet out the scientists that I want to look at, Dr. Meldrum's, he's the top in the field, and consulting with him on who else could be a leading scholar in their field, primatology, anthropology, we came up with a list, and it includes Les Stroud. Even though he's not academia, he's somebody who's approached the subject pretty realistically, and I've gathered some partners, and we decided to let's put this conference together and have fun and do it in an area where people can address this academia and then have a little fun afterwards. That's why we're doing it in a safari reserve.
Well, let's get some worldwide exposure on this for you, Bill, and because I want the world to realize what's going on in the search for Bigfoot. I really do. So that'll be interesting. Okay, Bill, thanks. We'll be in touch with you as you get close to this. This event, Jeffrey, is in September of next year, right?
That's right, September of 2015.
And then another person is on, of course, with us, and that is the Falcon Project director, William Barnes. So let's grab William for a moment here. This is an exciting undertaking, William. I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah, it's a little different how... Like to say hi to Meldrum there and you, Mr. Nori.
Yes, sir.
Yes, it's a very unique way of doing research, and it's the only thing left that I could find after doing research on researchers for many years that we have to go to the sky and use very high-end equipment. I mean, very high-end equipment. And it's to... make it work in my eyes is all about terrain. They live in all types of terrain, and a lot of people, I want to let them know that, you know, we're not going to go in the deep forest where we cannot see the forest floor. We'll be in areas that where we can see the forest floor more often than we can. And also I do want to say that I don't know, I need to ask Meldrum something real quick. Did you mention the ground crew yet?
No, we didn't touch on that. So go ahead.
Okay. We're putting together a ground crew for 6 months stretch out in the woods.
Wow.
10 intense. People. And these people are not going to see society. This is a research study program of these creatures in known areas of active areas. And I'm putting people together as we speak. This is the ongoing project, and it would be the first stage of the Falcon Project as the airship is being built. And then we bring the airship in with the ground crew. And we, by then, with 6 months in advance, we should have a good idea, hopefully in the area we're in with the activity that we find, that it will help us coordinate the Falcon Project as it goes along.
William, if for some reason the ground crew is successful and finds Bigfoot or Sasquatch, are you still going to do the Falcon aerial project?
Of course. That's the only way you're going to study them.
That's what I was saying, George, that's when the work really begins. Because the only way, it's not like where Jane Goodall could go up and sit on the side of the mountain and habituate a large troop of chimpanzees to her presence and follow their daily activities. These are solitary, nocturnal, far-ranging creatures that those are characteristics of any species that make them notoriously difficult to study in their natural habitat under natural conditions.
All right, stay with us, Jeffrey. We're going to take some final calls with you when we come back. William Barnes, thank you. Good luck on this project, the Falcon Project, where they're going to fly a drone over a certain area. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Jeffrey Meldrum. Hey, have you had a chance yet to watch our program, Beyond Belief? You can. You can watch it for free for 10 days. This week, Chris Geo is on talking about survival tactics, and it's an incredible program, so make sure you're part of that. Beyond Belief, www.beyondbelief.com. Jeffrey, though September of 2015 is quite a ways away, any concerns about Ebola from those West African nations down in South Africa?
Well, no, in fact, that's why the date has been actually pushed back. Originally, it was scheduled to be in the springtime, and you know, out of deference to the concerns raised by potential registrants and just the you know, the feeling that the corner hadn't quite been turned on that outbreak, we decided to push it back to September. And I think the way things are developing now, and everything will be fine.
I assume if somebody wants to go to South Africa, they are allowed to go to this event?
That's right. They are. It's open to the public, to any registrant that wants to participate. You know, we have accommodations for about 100 registrants. And so it'll be a really great event. It'll be spread over several days. There will be presentations, you know, panels and discussions each day, punctuated with excursions out into the game reserve. So it'll be, you know, a fascinating intellectual conference combined with, a singular safari experience, given the facilities and the opportunities there at Zulu Niala Game Reserve.
Okay, let's go to Jim in Pensacola, Florida. Welcome to the program, Jimmy. Go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon, George, Dr. Meldrum.
Yes,
I'm very impressed with your Sasquatch field guide. I'd like to buy several for my friends that live in obscure areas.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced a skunk ape or something like it in Upper Alabama, and a shaman had taught me how to walk through the woods almost silently. And I think I scared one of these things, and he let out a noise when I surprised him, and I very audibly unloaded my intestines. And I think the thing laughed and ran away, but I wasn't sure.
I really couldn't comment on that. As far as the field guide, though, if you want to email me privately, we can certainly arrange to get some more of those in your hand if you want them personalized or autographed or anything like that. Otherwise, the field guide is available generally on Amazon or through the publisher Paradise K. That's a C-A-Y in Arcata, California.
Are you aware of the work of Dr. Brian Sykes, Jeffrey?
I am, yes. That was, you know, in the wake of some of the controversy surrounding Dr. Ketchum's study and the inconclusive outcomes of that effort, I was personally very excited at Dr. Sykes' involvement in the subject. I was a little disappointed in the design of the study and his wholesale testing of every hair sample that came to him. Something that investigators out there need to bear in mind, and I discussed this in the field guide, in fact, is that hair is very prolific out there in the environment. Hair from all different animals, all different mammals, that is, mammal species. And it persists for a long time, so that even if you collect hair from a bush or from a branch in association with an alleged sighting or encounter, it doesn't necessarily mean that hair came from the Sasquatch. And so it wasn't surprising when Dr. Sykes's results turned up every kind of animal you could imagine, from human to deer and elk and coyote, all the way down to porcupine. So I was a little disappointed in that. We actually have a project, another subsequent project going on, where I have screened hair samples that have been submitted to me, and a half a dozen or so of those have been submitted to Dr. Todd Disitel at NYU. New York University, in cooperation with a documentary that is obviously financing that investigation. These hair samples under the microscope all are remarkably consistent, except for two. There were two samples. Well, I can't divulge any more than that until the documentary comes out. And again, publicly, let me tell the people that have been very patient with me. I'm under some strictures as to what I can say and can't say to even the donors as to what those results are until the documentary airs. But But hopefully the results will be more positive. The one thing that we always run into with the hair that we think is from Sasquatch based on the morphology is the presence of or the lack of presence of a medulla, a cellular medulla. Sasquatch hair seems to lack that one characteristic, which in shed hair that doesn't have a skin tag or a actively dividing hair follicle, most of the DNA that's extracted from a hair shaft is found in that cellular medulla. The absence of that medulla, which is not a mysterious characteristic, it's found even in some human samples. The absence of that makes it much more challenging to get DNA from those hair shafts. And so sometimes the results are not forthcoming.
Jeffrey, how come this creature is so elusive?
Well, I think it's a combination of a number of factors. The most fundamental one is simply that they're so rare. I mean, you know, when you consider, again, what's the context? This is a relic hominoid, a relic large ape, or early hominin ancestor, or relative, rather. They are, that type of an animal, large primate, is always very rare, very low in number, at least under current experience and known species. You combine that with the fact, as we said earlier, that they are relatively solitary and nocturnal, mostly in their behaviors, it seems. You know, you combine all those things plus the intelligence of a large ape. You know, they're smarter than the average bear, as Yogi would say. And that combination of characteristics creates a circumstance where you're dealing with a species that, well, I think there's probably a bit of a tug of war where their intelligence creates some curiosity about human activities, the sights and smells and sounds of civilization, human activities. So they're drawn to that, but also the intelligence helps them. It's not the only attribute. I mean, you know, prize buck can be very elusive come hunting season. And anyone experienced in the outdoors can tell you that. So, and that's an important point. People who are familiar with wildlife behavior, who, you know, who are hunters and so forth, will tell you that it's not surprising that that even a very large species like this could remain elusive and essentially unrecognized all this time.
Let's go out to Oregon, where there are many Bigfoot sightings. Jill's with us on Coast to Coast. Jill, go ahead. Thank you.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I was listening to a program on Discovery last week, and they had a program about the Yeti, mm-hmm. and they found some hair, and so the doctor took it and, you know, he matched it with all these different samples he had. Uh-huh. It came out that it matched with a 400,000-year-old polar bear.
Yeah. 40,000,
actually. And I wondered if you've heard anything about this.
Oh, yes, certainly have. Heard a lot about this. And again, this is another disappointing sensationalization of an otherwise very explicable result.
Yeah.
There's a lot of confusion in the lore surrounding the Yeti. With bear, you know, whether it is a bear or whether it is a human. So, you know, when you look at the footprints, the vast majority of footprints that have been attributed to the Yeti can easily be identified as a bear. You know, and I often puzzled over that. I thought, why is this? Are the Sherpas who are asserting to their you know, sahibs that this is a Yeti, are they so naive that they don't really know the difference between an ape-like foot or a humanoid-like foot and a bear foot? Or are they so disingenuous that they're just telling the Western mountaineers or explorers what they think they want to hear? Well, I came upon a little passage in a book written by a native Indian about the lore surrounding the Yeti, and it made it very clear to me. To their mind, to their perception, their worldview, the Yeti is foremost a spiritual entity. It is the spirit of the mountains, and it can be embodied. It can become corporeal or be corporeal, but it can be corporeal in a variety of forms. And so whether that's a pilgrim or a bear or an ape-like creature. And so when footprints are found in these high elevations, these high passes, in a place that's inexplicable, you know, they come upon a bear track, a B-A-R bear, they conclude it must be a Yeti. It must be the spirit of the mountains manifest, because what else would what business would a bear have up here at, you know, 25,000 feet up in the mountains? So unfortunately now, Dr. Sykes tested some samples, which were obviously from bear pelts. I mean, you can tell the difference. Again, this comes back to the screening process. The guard hairs and differentiated underfur of a bear are absolutely distinct from the modified guard hairs and lack of underfur found in primates. The specimens that he tested could easily have been eliminated as simply misidentified bear. And the fact that it matched a 40,000-year-old sequence from a polar bear wasn't that surprising to any bear biologist who knows that polar bears have repeatedly through prehistory been isolated on the mainlands as the Arctic ice sheet has waxed and waned. And during some of those periods, there was introgression of genes from the brown bear populations. And so that particular sample of a 40,000-year-old jaw had genes of brown bears. Not that polar bears originated in the Himalayas, but that there had been brown bear genes that were shared in common with brown bears in the Himalayas in that particular polar bear that dated to 40,000 years when that population was isolated in Scandinavia, when the Arctic ice sheet had melted. So, but boy, I tell you, that was another story that just took off like feathers in the wind.
Sure did.
And and just obfuscated the whole question of whether there's a species of great ape in the Himalayas that is as yet unrecognized.
Let's go to Robert in Chicago. Hey, Robert, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, George, and happy holidays to you and your guest.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Jeffrey, I just believe it's all nonsense. I just don't believe that there is a Sasquatch out there. Unless he's an alien or she's an alien, with all these sightings, there's never been a body produced. With the Patterson case, you had that one gentleman who came forward. He took a lie test. He said that he was in that costume. You still have people that believe in that that Sasquatch or Bigfoot from the Patterson case. But this, like I say, this one gentleman, according to the information that I saw,
right,
he took a lie test and he passed the lie test. He said he was in that costume. Why is it? I mean, I just can't believe after all these years, there's no body. I think you're on a wild goose chase, with all due respect, Jeffrey.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. And certainly that's the vexing issue, isn't it? It remains a mystery because we don't have a body. And you know, many of the professional skeptics out there, Michael Shermer has written a column, you know, the science starts when you have a body.
He's had a field day.
Which I disagree with completely. But, you know, you rattled off a few things, like the Patterson-Gimlin film and the lie detector test that Bob Hieronymus took. People pass lie detector tests all the time. That's why they're not allowed as evidentiary in adjudications. I mean, it's that in itself, he couldn't get his story right if his life depended on it, and it differed from the other claims. You know, he linked up with Phil Morris, who claimed to be the man who built the costume, and yet when you read the two descriptions of these alleged costume, they're absolutely diametrically opposite from one another. In their details, in the materials they were made from, in the pieces, in the way the head was constructed, I mean, so forth. You would have thought that if they were going to get together to corroborate one another's story, that they would have got the story straight. So setting all that aside, on the basis of the analysis of that film, and one of the projects I'm currently deeply involved with is collaborating with Bill Munns, who's a former Hollywood makeup artist and costume fabricator, designer, who has taken a real interest in this whole question and has applied his expertise in costume design as well as his depth of understanding of the history and technical aspects of cinematography to the film itself, the physical film, as well as the analysis of the film subject. And from my point of view as a comparative primate anatomist and student of human locomotion, we've been working together and have already published a couple of papers. And Bill has written a fantastic book entitled When Roger Met Patty. And if you want to have a different perspective on the Patterson-Gimlin film, take a look at that book, because I really think that there is no question left, or there will be no justified question or question of foundation once this analysis is completed, that this is a photographic record of an unrecognized relic hominoid.
Well, and you know, Jeffrey, we have to factor in that so many people are reporting seeing something. They're not lying. They're not making it up. They're seeing something. Of course, we don't know exactly what this creature is at this point.
That's right.
But with all these people reporting, you know, seeing something run across the road or out in the
sure.
woods, something's
sure.
happening there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and the question of where's the body, again, to just to revisit that, if you talk to people who have spent time in the woods, in the field, you will find that when you ask how many corpses of a brown bear have you found, you know, this one gentleman in a book recently was pointed out to me has studied bears in the field for 30 years, and in that whole time he has found nothing more than a small little fragment of a skull of a brown bear. But and what if you took something even less common, more similar in its natural history, say, to a Sasquatch, like a wolverine, a very solitary, reclusive, retreating animal? How many wolverines' skeletons or corpses have been found in the wild that have died under natural conditions? And, you know, it's not the absence of a physical body at this point is itself not damning to the question. And certainly, in my mind, does not negate all of the other trace and potential physical evidence like scat and hair that we have, the trace footprints and handprints, other body prints, and so forth. I mean, there, and as you pointed out, George, it's easy from one's armchair to simply dismiss all eyewitness encounters
That's
as
right.
misidentification or embellishment or outright lying. But when you have experienced, sober witnesses who have nothing to gain and everything to lose, you know, this the landscape has changed in the past 40 years with the advent of the internet and cable channel documentaries and so forth. But, you know, 40 years ago, when you came out and said that you saw a giant hairy ape man, you were going to be labeled as a kook.
Not anymore. Jeffrey, we're out of time. Do keep in touch with us, and let's talk way before you go out to South Africa next September. I'll be back in a moment as we talk about channeling entities next.